This week, our castaway is the comedian Frankie Howard. Frankie, could you endure prolonged loneliness?
You mean alone, prolongedly, on a desert island?
That's it.
Well, it's the old joke, because it's better than the alternative.
What's
it's
that?
Being dead.
Well, yes.
You see what I mean? But I wouldn't like it for too long, no.
Would you be happiest to have got away from?
Well, I think the thing is that I would sometimes be happiest to get away from would be me. And that's the one thing I'd be thrown together with, if you see what I mean.
Very close.
So I wouldn't be happy to get away from people. Traffic jams. That's definitely traffic jam.
Not a traffic jam within 1,000 miles.
No.
How much of a musician are you? Do you play the piano?
I started to when I was a child, but I gave it up because I couldn't concentrate. I was just lazy, I think. But I loved music. I always liked music. What I used to do when I was a little boy, I used to conduct concerts. I used to listen to the radio in those days, and they used to have concerts on the radio. So I had my own in my mind. I used to hum, would you believe?
Yes.
Also, I was in a choir, of course, when I was a little boy.
Did you find it difficult in choosing your 8 records to narrow it down to
just
8?
Yes, I did. Well, you know I did, because I sat there almost sweating with worry, because I tell you why. I like music in general. I like all sorts of classical, pop, modern music. And to try and get 8, if you'd said to me, now you've got 2,000 you can have on, that's much easier, really. But to try and pick 8, I found very, very difficult.
Well, you did eventually get down to just 8. What's the first one?
Well, the first one, and I'll tell you why. First of all, I used to be in the old... I came in at the end of the old music hall era. I was in the music hall. I started in the music halls after the war. But it was the end of the great days of the music hall. Also, during my life, I like to give parties, which you might call rather common. We jig around doing, you know, dances and get Scotch reels and all sorts of things. No grace much, but plenty of a bit of grog.
Vigor
is the word, isn't it? Larry a bit. Bit knees up Mother Brownie. So I thought to myself, what sort of party thing are we to cheer up? I don't know, I want to dance a bit, don't I?
Of course you do.
To sit there looking at a tree or something. So I thought, I want to jig around. So what better than what? The most obvious thing for a knees up, isn't it? Knees up Mother Brown, would you believe?
Knees Up Mother Brown, sung by the audience at the old Metropolitan Edgware Road.
I bet it's the first time you've ever been asked to play this on this program, isn't it?
Did you ever play the Met?
Yes, oh yes, many times, the old Met Edgware Road, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, I loved it there.
Now, you were born in the city of York. Did you stay there during your childhood?
For about 3 years. And then my father brought me down to London to live on the outskirts of London because he was in the army.
Yes.
So he was moved down, so I went with him.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
I have a brother and one sister, yeah. But they weren't born then, so they weren't born in York, I was.
Your father became ill, I believe. Did that mean that times were hard?
Oh, yes, because we're speaking, as you know, at the moment, of what is known as a recession, and I was brought up in the first recession. Times were very hard, but we had a lot of pleasure out of life.
Did you have the occasional visit to the theatre?
Yes, I went to the theatre. I tell you what I did, you see, but I was very fortunate in some respects, though we were poor. We had a what we call a straight theatre near us, where you could see straight plays, the Royal Artillery Theatre in Woolwich. Mm. And we also had the music hall at Lewisham, the Lewisham Hippodrome, you know, where there were great musical artists like Gracie Fields and Max Miller. So I dodged between the two. So I grew up, really, like a kind of split personality between the music hall and the rather posher, the more serious theatre. My first theatrical experience, would you believe? Well, I'm sure you believe it, was to see a pantomime. We sat in the gallery to see a pantomime.
Did it make a terrific impression on
you? Yes, it did. Yes, I loved it. I thought it was fabulous. I loved it. And I used to go to the pictures in those days. Yes, I was very show business struck.
Mm-hmm.
I never thought I'd be in it, mind you, but I was also hypnotised to it.
Now, you won a scholarship at school.
Yeah, thank you. You look surprised. Yes, I did. I wonder if you surprised me. I think it surprised everybody.
What did your parents want you to be?
I don't honestly know. I really don't know. I think, I have a feeling my mother would have liked me to go into the church. You wouldn't believe that, but yeah. I think so. I've never prodded, and so, see, my father died when I was very young. Yeah. So, a stronger influence, obviously, was my mother, but I don't think, she never said, you must do this or you must do that.
You did, in fact, teach in Sunday school.
So I was a Sunday school teacher at 13. Yeah. Yes. And I was very popular among the children because I decided that some of the stuff I was teaching was rather dreary. And so I used to make up the things as I went along and tell stories, which was very naughty.
And told them jokes.
Well, not jokes. Oh, no, I used to tell them stories about Robin Hood, as I remember. And the rest of the Sunday school teachers used to look at me and say, isn't he marvellous? He's riveting their attention. Little did they know what I was telling them about. Mind you, it was all very innocent and romantic. But I felt very guilty about that. I thought I wasn't preaching entirely the word of God. But at least it kept them interested, and they came to the Sunday school.
Surely.
It was the first audience, in a way, I suppose, that kind of audience. Let's have egotistical your... then. Oh, dear, naughty. What?
Let's have your second record.
Oh, yes. I thought the first one was a bit common. I'll show my night posher side now, my more refined side. I like a lot of classical music, all classical, I say almost classical music. One of my favourites is Chopin. I like Chopin very much. And I thought I'd choose a bit of Chopin, but I wouldn't choose one of those flowery bits, you know, those long, those which are marvellous. But I thought I'd choose something quiet, gentle, to go to sleep to. Is he going to sleep with it or by it or to it? Whatever. Mm. Anyway, to sleep. And it's a nocturne, which means night, doesn't it? Night,
yes, it
night,
does. Yes,
in C minor. And it's played here by Arthur Rubinstein, who I saw a lot of times, who was a genius.
The opening section of Chopin's Nocturne in C minor, Opus 48, number 1, played by Arthur Rubinstein. When was it that you veered towards the theatre?
Oh, well, I veered towards it when I was 13, because I was in the Church Dramatic Society, the other church I was telling you about.
Yes.
The Sunday School. And I used to have an impediment... Oh, dear, here I go again a bit. An impediment of speech in those days, particularly when I got nervous. And I think they all felt sorry for me, so they put me in a play called Tilio Bloomsbury.
Now,
I
was Ian Hay, wasn't
it? Ian Hay, that's right. And I played the part of Tilly's father, because I was too young. I was only 13 to play anything else, really. I couldn't play Tilly, and she was too tall for that. So I played Tilly's father with a beard. And that was the first time I smelt grease paint. And then I had no ego in on the stage to enjoy it, just to be part of it, and I thought it was marvellous. And it was one of the most exciting nights of my life. I completely forgot myself, but I got a good press. The local press gave me a very good notice. And the churchwarden said to me, Frankie said, now, that's what you must be, an actor. An actor. So I thought, right. Now I know how I'm meant to be.
What was your first job when you left school?
In the docks, in Tooley Street, yes. In London.
He's doing what?
Well, as little as possible. I got a job eventually as a filing, an office boy, really, a filing clerk. I was appalling.
Were you?
I really was a disaster. I got the sack. All I was thinking about was shows. I see. I was in dramatics, amateur dramatics all the time, and I used to run a concert party.
That's right.
I got my ego back by that time.
With your name over the title.
Yeah, I was in... In this concert party, I used to call it Frank Howard's Knockouts Concert Party. There were 22 items, and I was in 21. Now, how I managed to get out of the 22nd, I don't know.
Well, you were the boss.
Right, I was. I know. I made sure of that. Oh, dear.
Then the war came along, and you were planning to join ENSA and entertain the troops.
No, when the war came along, I got the sack from this first job. I was in an insurance company, which I quite liked. I mean, they weren't kind to me. But then the war came along, and I thought to myself, well, I'm bound to be rejected by reason of insanity. But for the first time, I actually passed an audition for my medical, and I thought, well, I think I could be more help if I was to be sort of trying to be funny. So I went to ENSA. In Drury Lane, Drury Lane Theatre, and they looked at me and they said, well, I don't know, no, so no. So I was not, I went into the army. So I went through the whole war, really, as a soldier.
After your basic training, where were you posted?
Well, I went down to South End to start with, and I got posted to an experimental station. My sergeant major never quite knew what I was there for. He used to call me the unknown quantity.
You were guarding South End from invasion?
Indeed. And they're very grateful, may I say.
I think so.
Yes, I was out on the seashore. There were sandbags. We had and a rifle. There was no bullets, mind you, because they couldn't afford bullets. Mm-hmm. True. They would try to scare them off by sheer making faces. The German invasion.
There were several of you guarding.
Not many, though, actually. Yes. And used to walk on the other night waiting for German parachutists to land as nuns or something. Or vice versa, I know that.
And it gets very cold in winter in South End.
Yes, except it was in summer, Roy.
Oh,
got your facts
good.
Wrong there.
Yes, right.
But it was very nice. No, it was lovely countryside. I got lovely and brown. I loved that bit.
Where did you go next?
Oh, I went down to South Wales, where I was...
To defend that?
I think they defended me. I did a lot of shows there, and I did a lot of shows in South End. I still couldn't do it sort of as a part of the army, but I did it in spare time.
A civilian concert party?
Well, it wasn't... I did some civilian concert parties as well, even though I was a soldier. But I did it in YMCAs and NAFIs and just barrack rooms, anywhere they would put up with me, I did it. Mm-hmm. And then I went over to Germany, France, yes. Belgium, Germany.
They made you a sergeant?
No, you're wrong again, Roy. But near.
Near?
Near, a corporal. One down.
Oh, yeah.
But... You are right, because I became a sergeant eventually. I crawled sufficiently to become a sergeant eventually.
Let's have another record. Yeah. Number three.
Well, now, the posh side again, I think. I like choral music. I also like symphony music, classical music. And I thought, on a desert island, have something joyful and noisy. And I kind of, you can join in this in a way, if you know it. It's a part of the last part of Beethoven's Choral Symphony,
yes.
Which is the Ninth Symphony.
And the hymn to joy.
Yes, that's why. It's joy, happiness.
Part of the last movement of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, Otto Klemperer conducting the Philharmonia Orchestra and Chorus. Now, what happened when you were demobilised?
Well, just before I was demobilised, I actually got into an army concert party, after the war had finished and we were all stationed in Germany, and they wanted something to amuse the ladies and gentlemen of the forces. And it was about 6 months before I was demobbed. And I enjoyed doing that very much. Anyway, the major in charge gave me a little note, a little sort of reference, saying, this, I think this man should do, like a reference. You see. So I went to try and plunge into show business professionally.
Yes.
Well, I went to auditions, I couldn't get anywhere.
You wanted to get into variety?
Well, yes, variety. Yeah, because by this time I'd given up the idea of doing anything else, obviously. So it was variety.
What sort of act did you have?
A patter act, mm-hmm. Talking. Very much on the lines of the sort of thing I, you know, got well known for on the radio, which was, The thing was, in those days, when I was doing all these acts around as an amateur, I couldn't afford a script writer, so I took an old jokes that I'd heard from the music hall, Max Miller and people like that, well-known jokes, and I used to do these jokes, and I used to think to myself, now, how can I make them sound different? So by sheer cunning, desperation, I used to spin them out. And in order to do this, I used to do all these sort of saying, well, now, yes, if this woman can stop that. And this went on, that was 5 minutes to get into this. And at the end of it all, I used to think, at the tagline, I must try and alter that and make it sound different. So I sort of got a more rambling, conversational style that way. It was desperation, really. What is that saying? Mother with necessity is the word, mother of invention or something?
Necessity is the mother of invention.
That's right.
So you were travelling round in variety.
Round and round and round.
Until you got your lucky break. What was it?
Well, it was a break on radio. They were looking for a comedian to alternate with the resident comedian, who was called Derek Roy, and he was 1 week, and they wanted someone for the other week, alternate weeks. And I went for an audition, never thinking for a second I'd get it. And they put me in a room like this, which is all kind of soundproofed or whatever it is, except there were sandbags there, I remember, which was after the war. And this lady producer sat behind the glass panel, such as you've got here, your producer, and afterwards I thought, well, that's it, for that no good. She came out, it's terrible to laugh, because that was marvellous. All this sort of thing.
Did she give you a job?
Yes, she gave me the job. In Variety Bandbox, at the bottom of the bill.
It was a very important programme.
Oh,
listen to
it was.
Millions of people.
Oh, it was a very popular programme. In fact, I would have thought it was probably the number one variety show at that time.
Well, there you are. That seems a good point to break off for your next record. What now?
Well, I went to the music halls, and I did a music hall act, and my pianist, my lady pianist, was there. And for many years, I did a song. I sang Would You Believe Straight, and then I did a sort of comedy thing after it. And often now I'm in restaurants and my manager or friends, if there's a band, they often ask them to play this particular song because it was the sort of thing that they associated with me over, what, nearly 20 years. It's a sentimental song. And so I've chosen that to remind me, really, of my musical days. You may think it's an odd choice for musical, but I did this on the musicals and with my pianist. And it's Autumn Leaves. And, of course, in those days, the great singer of it was Nat King Cole.
The falling leaves drift by the window. The autumn leaves of red and gold. I see your lips, the summer kisses, the sunburned hands I used to hold. Since you went away, the days grow long. And soon I'll hear old winter's song. But I miss you most of all, my darling, when autumn leaves start to fall.
Autumn Leaves, sung not by Frankie Howard, but by Nat King Cole. You talked about the importance to a comedian of material. and these days with television and radio and whatever, you use a lot of it. Yes. You were lucky when years ago a young man called on you one night in Sheffield.
Oh, Eric, you mean, Eric Sykes.
Eric Sykes.
Yes, he sent me a letter first and enclosed some scripts in it, and I thought, oh, no, he's a script writer which I could badly do with, because I'd been writing my own stuff till then, and he came along and he stayed with me in Variety Bandmonks for a long time, writing, and then he gradually branched out on his own and wrote for other people, and then he performed his own material eventually, yes. And an extremely talented boy. He was obviously very, when I first met him, very, very talented. Mm-hmm. I've been very fortunate because I worked with an awful lot of talented people. I'm talking about writers at the moment. A lot of talented writers. I've discovered some, would you believe? Some people have done very well. And I made a lot of mistakes in my life, and sometimes misjudgments, very bad. But my judgments, particularly in those days, about writers wasn't bad. I mean, I discovered a lot of people who became very famous.
And soon you branched out from the music hall. You've done just about the lot, haven't you? Straight plays, Shakespeare.
Well, you mean straight plays in the sense of the word, I suppose, that they were...
They were straight until you got
them. But they were comedy parts. I mean, yes. They were comedy parts. They weren't... I wasn't Hamlet. I have no Hamlet complex.
Do you find it hard to discipline yourself to stick to the author's script?
Yes. Yes, but it depends on the script. I mean, when I did Shakespeare, I didn't think it needed changing very much.
No.
Generally speaking, you sometimes can amend a little, put a little bit here and then a little bit there just to alter it around slightly. I just finished Gilbert and Sullivan. I didn't alter particularly. Mm. I did a bit, 3 or 4% to make it slightly me, but not. I mean, I wouldn't have the impertinence to alter Gilbert and Sullivan.
There was a time in the late 50s, I think, mid-50s, you were having a tremendous success, and then you had a very bad patch.
Well, that came till the end of the 50s, just about 59.
It was a time when show business was in a very unstable position. The music hall had collapsed, and commercial television had just come in.
Yeah. And you pop singers, of course. Yes. Pop singers had taken the stage.
And you had the misfortune to be in one or two unfortunate productions.
Yes. Yes, and partly my own bad judgment. Well, yeah. It's silly to blame everybody else. I made mistakes too. But it was a difficult period, let's put it that way.
Yes, a bad patch. Mm. Well, we'll leave you in the Slough of Despond for a moment or two while we play your next disc. What's that?
Well, I like all sorts of music. I like opera. And when I was younger, I used to listen to operatic music. I like Puccini because it's romantic and it's got some good tunes in it. And I've chosen a piece of Puccini, but not necessarily the best known, you know what I mean. But it is well known. It's from Tosca, and it's Love and Music. And it was sung a lot on the radio once, or played a lot on the radio on the record by Joan Hammond. So I've chosen that.
Joan Hammond singing Love and Music from the second act of Tosca. Now, Frankie, we were talking about that bad breakdown in your career 25 years ago. You didn't let it get you down. You went off and travelled, didn't you?
Well, I used to... I walked a lot, as a matter of fact. That's how I travelled. I walked with my legs. One, I had to keep going. I worked when I could. I mean, yes. I did one or two summer seasons, mm-hmm. and I just had to sort of struggle on, hoping to... get out of it one day, out of a sort of valley, which I hope one day I would get through. And thank God I did, eventually.
You tried something new.
Well, you mean satire?
Yes.
Yes. Well, I tell you what, I went into nightclubs, would you believe? Because I was a bit desperate. I needed money. We have to live on something, you know? And I went into a nightclub in London called the Blue Angel. And the nightclub owner was very nice to me. He was a very kind man. And then I was asked to go to the establishment, which was a young satirical nightclub. And I thought, I don't think it's for me, you know, this musical comic going this terribly sophisticated nightclub. Anyway, I did go. And it was very successful, as a matter of fact. And from there, I was asked to go on to a television show called That Was What That Was, which was also very successful.
Yes.
And things suddenly took an upturn. Mm. And it's a very strange thing in life, that for no apparent reason, things started to sort of whiz up again.
Yes, indeed.
Ups and downs life.
And then a very successful American musical.
Well, you mean The Forum? Yes,
a funny thing happened on the way.
I was up in Coventry, would you believe, doing a pantomime. And they said that the American producers and writers were over, and they'd been recommended, I believe, by Sir John Gielgud, would you believe, that I should play this part.
Yes.
And they came to see me in pantomime, and I thought to myself, I've had it, of course, because the Americans, as you know, never have seen English pantomimes, and have no idea what it's all about at all. And I was doing these pantomime jokes, and I thought, dear God, they won't want this. This will be out. I was petrified. So I thought, well, if they come round after the show, that's a good sign. And if they don't, it means they've gone back to London. It's a terribly cold winter, too. Ice and snow. Never forget it. Anyway, I sat there after the performance and waited. I thought, now, will there be a knock or not? And about 10 minutes, bang, bang. I was just giving up hope, and in they walked. And they loved it. They were eating popcorn and sucking, you know, lollies, ice lollies. They loved joining the chorus.
Well,
I got the part. So I got the part, yeah.
Yes, you had a long run. And somebody thought that a toga suited you, and you continued to wear one in a hit television series.
Yeah, that's right, yes. About 5 years later, Pompeii, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, that was, see, the Forum was based on some plays by Plautus, a very old Roman, rather naughty writer, you see. And so the Pompeii was also based on these stories of Plautus, which just to show nothing much alters, does it, really? Because it's all wives chasing husbands and in and out of doors. And
same situations.
Same situations.
Gags are new.
Some of the ones we did weren't all that new. But it was very successful.
How many episodes?
We did too many. I mean, did 14.
Really?
Yeah. Did two series, that's all. No, just did 14. Did one series and did another one, that's all.
Record number 6.
Well, I was once described in one of the posh papers as a dramatic clown. Now, as you know, The Forum, the funny thing happened, The Forum was written by Stephen Sondheim, who's a very difficult composer to sing. He is. Mm. But he is also a very nice man and a brilliant composer. And so I thought, well, a clown. So I thought I'll go for Send In the Clowns, you see. And as you know, we argued, or we didn't argue, we discussed before, I should ask Mr. Sinatra to sing it or Mr. This to sing it. And I thought, well, eventually I plumped for Cleo Lane, because Cleo and I have been fairly friendly for years now. About 20 years I've known Cleo and her husband, Johnny, and so here's Cleo Lane singing it.
Isn't it rich? Are we a pair? Me here at last on the ground, you in midair, send in the clowns. Isn't it bliss? Don't you approve? One who keeps tearing around, one who can't move. Where are the clowns? Send in the clowns. Just when I'd start opening doors, finally knowing the one that I wanted was yours. Making my entrance again with my usual flair. My lines, no one is there. Don't you love us? My fault, I fear. I thought that you'd want what I want. Sorry, my dear, but where are the clowns? Quick, send in the clowns. Don't bother, they are here.
Cleo Lane singing Send in the Clowns from A Little Night Music. Now, recent events, Frankie. Mm. At the moment, you're in Viennese opera.
Would you believe? in it, but not of it. Yes. Well, people say to me, oh, you're here in opera, you know, which is, of course, I mean, it's, the opera, I mean, Deflated Mouse, of course, isn't exactly a, you know, terribly sort of, what is the word, difficult to follow. It's got some lovely tunes in it. It's very tuneful music. I've always liked it, anyway. I like Viennese music.
I love Viennese music.
I've always liked Viennese operetta. And this part, as you know, is a part which doesn't sing in it at all.
Right.
Part of a drunken jailer. You may think I'm typecast. But, yes, Frosch. And it comes in the last act only.
There's not very much of Frosch written down, is there?
I've had to put a bit in. I put a little in.
I thought you might.
Yes, I have put a bit in. Yes. Much the astonishment of the cast, they got used to it.
Slightly
very
different.
Nice crowd. The Eiffel Opera singers would be sort of different, but they aren't just as down to earth as we are. We're all in the canteen eating eggs and chips during the rehearsals.
And Frosch slightly different every night?
Not very much. Not too much. I tell you why. It would throw the other members of the company
yes,
if you suddenly started to ad lib and things like that. Mm-hmm. But I enjoy doing it very much.
Well, I can see that because you've chosen a disc from.
Yes, that's not the reason I chose it, actually. I was going to choose a Viennese opera piece anyway, operetta. But this is a piece I've liked. And I haven't gone for the big pop stuff, but still it's, I think, popular enough. I mean, well-known enough. I don't know how you call it. Brother Mine. It's in the second act.
Brother Mine and Sister Mine.
Yes, that's right. It's a lovely waltz. I like waltzes.
And Sister Mine from the second act of Johann Strauss's Die Fledermaus, Herbert von Karajan conducting the cast, of course, and the Vienna State Opera Chorus and the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra. Frankie, how well could you look after yourself on a desert island? Are you a practical man? Could you build a shelter?
No, I'm not very practical at all. It might be a good idea if I learned to be practical, as a matter of fact, because it's, you know, I might have to cope and do things I otherwise wouldn't bother.
What about food? Done any fishing?
Well, I must tell you, I've never been a fisherman till I went to Australia. And I went on the Barrier Reef, which is fabulous. And they said, will you go out fishing one day? And I said, I don't know if I'd be. But I quite enjoyed it. And it was those big fish, you know, you pull and they just, what do they call the sailfish and all those enormous fish in the coral waters and there were a few sharks around too, might I say. Yeah. But I might guess we all saw the fish back again when we got them in and they, off they went. But I liked it and sat down in the beautiful blue water. And a little drop of rum, I remember, and Coke. Oh, yes. The more rum I drank, the more I enjoyed it, strangely enough. You wouldn't believe that, would you?
Would you try to escape?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, eventually, yes. Yes, that'd be nice for 2 or 3 weeks, but not forever. Oh, no, I wouldn't. No, I wouldn't live. No, no, certainly I'd try to escape.
Right.
Yes, definitely.
You've got one more record. What's your last one?
When we were very little, I was a very little boy, 4, 5, 6, the school I went to, the elementary school in London, the Gordon School of Eltham, we used to have, in those days, what was called Empire Day, which is now gone, a long time ago. And all the little children had to sing, you see, and like a service, guided by the headmaster. And we invited, all the parents were invited, and they all sat round the quadrangle on the playground while we were all in our best suits, and we sang.
A lot of Union Jacks.
The little Union Jacks. Well, there weren't many, actually, because it wasn't a rich school at all. But all the parents came to look at the children. I stood there looking for my mother at the side there, thinking. And I can remember to this day, standing there singing this with the children, feeling very proud to be singing among a lot of children. And that was my first sort of appearance, so to speak. It was in a chorus, children's chorus, a long time ago. I never forgot it. It's Paris, Jerusalem.
Paris 13 of Jerusalem, sung by the Coventry Cathedral Boys Choir. If you could take only one disc out of the 8 you've chosen, which would it be?
I honestly don't know. I'm almost going to say I'm not going to answer the question because I honestly don't know. But I suppose if you held a pistol to my head, which I trust you're not going to do, I might plump for the last record because it is children.
Jerusalem.
And children are hope for the future.
And one luxury to take to the island with you, nothing of any practical use, something you'd like to have.
Well, now, that would be an ornament, would it?
Ornamental, or yes?
For instance, if I have to say to you that after my mother had died, among a lot of things were left, was a little cross which was given to me. Could I take that?
Of course you could.
Well, that's what I would take, a little cross which I've got. Yes.
And one book. You've got the Bible and Shakespeare already on the island. What's the one that you would take?
Well, there again, I've heard the programme many times, of course, and I think I would take a book, not so much just to read, but so I could act. And so I've decided on David Copperfield, because there's a lot of good parts there. And you see, if I was on the island alone, I hope to get back into show business when I got off the island.
Yes.
I want to keep my voice in trim. See, so I dance in Knees Like Mother Brown, so I want some voices, so I can say Mr. Micawber or hello, and little Dickens voices, and keep the voice going, so I can act all the parts out.
A splendid idea. You can come back and knock the eye of the Roy Shakespeare Company with your Nicholas Nickleby and put on your David Copperfield.
Or do all the parts myself.
Of course. Much cheaper.
Much cheaper for them. yes.
And thank you, Frankie Howard, for letting us hear your Desert Island Disc.
Thank you very much. Most happy.
Goodbye, everyone.